Dr. Ferris volunteered no questions, no eager offers of service. He remained seated, merely waiting. Dr. Stadler reached over and made the book slide from the corner to the center of his desk, with a contemptuous flick of one hand. "Will you tell me, please?" he asked. "What is this piece of indecency?" Dr. Ferris did not glance at the book, but kept his eyes fixed on Stadler's for an inexplicable moment. Then he leaned back and said with an odd smile, "I feel honored that you chose to make such an exception for my sake as reading a popular book. This little piece has sold 20,000 copies in 2 weeks. I have read it, and I expect an explanation. Did you find the text confusing?" Dr. Stadler looked at him in bewilderment. "Do you realize what theme you chose to treat, and in what manner? The style alone, the style, the gutter kind of attitude, for a subject of this nature. Do you think, then, that the content deserved a more dignified form of presentation?" The voice was so innocently smooth that Dr. Stadler could not decide whether this was mockery. "Do you realize what you're preaching in this book?"
"Since you do not seem to approve of it, Dr. Stadler, I'd rather have you think that I wrote it innocently."
This was it, thought Dr. Stadler. This was the incomprehensible element in Ferris's manner. He had supposed that an indication of his disapproval would be sufficient, but Ferris seemed to remain untouched by it. "If a drunken lout could find the power to express himself on paper," said Dr. Stadler, "if he could give voice to his essence, the eternal savage, leering his hatred of the mind, this is the sort of book I would expect him to write. But to see it come from a scientist, under the imprint of this institute." But Dr. Stadler, this book was not intended to be read by scientists. It was written for that drunken lout.
"What do you mean?"
"For the general public."
"But good God! The feeblest imbecile should be able to see the glaring contradictions in every one of your statements."
"Let us put it this way, Dr. Stadler. The man who doesn't see that deserves to believe all my statements."
"But you've given the prestige of science to that unspeakable stuff. It was all right for a disreputable mediocrity like Simon Pritchett to drool it as some sort of woozy mysticism. Nobody listened to him. But you've made them think it's science. Science! You've taken the achievement of the mind to destroy the mind. By what right did you use my work to make an unwarranted, preposterous switch into another field? Pull an inapplicable metaphor and draw a monstrous generalization out of what is merely a mathematical problem? By what right did you make it sound as if I gave my sanction to that book?"
Dr. Ferris did nothing. He merely looked at Dr. Stadler calmly. But the calm gave him an air that was almost patronizing.
"Now you see, Dr. Stadler, you're speaking as if this book were addressed to a thinking audience. If it were, one would have to be concerned with such matters as accuracy, validity, logic, and the prestige of science. But it isn't. It's addressed to the public. And you have always been first to believe that the public does not think."
He paused, but Dr. Stadler said nothing.
"This book may have no philosophical value whatever, but it has a great psychological value."
"Just what is that?"
"You see, Dr. Stadler, people don't want to think. And the deeper they get into trouble, the less they want to think. But by some sort of instinct, they feel that they ought to, and it makes them feel guilty. So they'll bless and follow anyone who gives them a justification for not thinking. Anyone who makes a virtue, a highly intellectual virtue, out of what they know to be their sin, their weakness, and their guilt."
"And you propose to pander to that?"
"That is the road to popularity."
"Why should you seek popularity?" Dr. Ferris's eyes moved casually to Dr. Stadler's face, as if by pure accident.
"We are a public institution," he answered evenly, "supported by public funds."
"So you tell people that science is a futile fraud which ought to be abolished?"
"That is a conclusion which could be drawn in logic from my book. But that is not the conclusion they will draw."
"And what about the disgrace to the Institute in the eyes of men of intelligence, wherever such may be left?"
"Why should we worry about them?"
Dr. Stadler could have regarded the sentence as conceivable,
had it been uttered with hatred, envy, or malice. But the absence of any such emotion, the casual ease of the voice, an ease suggesting a chuckle, hit him like a moment's glimpse of a realm that could not be taken as part of reality. The thing spreading down to his stomach was cold terror.
"Did you observe the reactions to my book, Dr. Stadler? It was received with considerable favor."
"Yes, and that is what I find impossible to believe." He had to speak. He had to speak as if this were a civilized discussion. He could not allow himself time to know what it was he had felt for a moment. "I am unable to understand the attention you received in all the reputable academic magazines, and how they could permit themselves to discuss your book seriously. If Hugh Axton were around, no academic publication would have dared to treat this as a work admissible into the realm of philosophy."
"He is not around."
Dr. Stadler felt that there were words which he was now called upon to pronounce, and he wished he could end this conversation before he discovered what they were.
"On the other hand," said Dr. Ferris, "the ads for my book. Oh, I'm sure you would notice such things as ads. Quote a letter of high praise which I received from Mr. Wesley Mooch."
"Who the hell is Mr. Wesley Mooch?"
Dr. Ferris smiled. "In another year, even you won't ask that question, Dr. Stadler. Let us put it this way. Mr. Mooch is the man who is rationing oil, for the time being."
"Then I suggest that you stick to your job. Deal with Mr. Mooch and leave him the realm of oil furnaces, but leave the realm of ideas to me."
"It would be curious to try to formulate the line of demarcation," said Dr. Ferris in the tone of an idle academic remark. "But if we're talking about my book, why then we're talking about the realm of public relations."
He turned to point solicitously at the mathematical formulas chalked on the blackboard.
"Dr. Stadler, it would be disastrous if you allowed the realm of public relations to distract you from the work which you alone on earth are capable of doing."
It was said with obsequious deference, and Dr. Stadler could not tell what made him hear in it the sentence,
"Stick to your blackboard."
He felt a biting irritation, and he switched it against himself, thinking angrily that he had to get rid of these suspicions. "Public relations?" he said contemptuously. "I don't see any practical purpose in your book. I don't see what it's intended to accomplish."
"Don't you?"
Dr. Ferris's eyes flickered briefly to his face. The sparkle of insolence was too swift to be identified with certainty. "I cannot permit myself to consider certain things as possible in a civilized society," Dr. Stadler said sternly.
"That is admirably exact," said Dr. Ferris cheerfully. "You cannot permit yourself."
Dr. Ferris rose, being first to indicate that the interview was ended.
"Please call for me whenever anything occurs in this institute to cause you discomfort, Dr. Stadler," he said. "It is my privilege always to be at your service."
Knowing that he had to assert his authority, smothering the shameful realization of the sort of substitute he was choosing, Dr. Stadler said imperiously, in a tone of sarcastic rudeness, "The next time I call for you, you'd better do something about that car of yours."
"Yes, Dr. Stadler, I shall make certain never to be late again, and I beg you to forgive me."
Dr. Ferris responded as if playing a part on cue, as if he were pleased that Dr. Stadler had learned at last the modern method of communication.
"My car has been causing me a great deal of trouble. It's falling to pieces, and I had ordered a new one some time ago, the best one on the market, a Hammond convertible. But Lawrence Hammond went out of business last week without reason or warning, so now I'm stuck. Those bastards seem to be vanishing somewhere. Something will have to be done about it."
When Ferris had gone, Dr. Stadler sat at his desk, his shoulders shrinking together, conscious only of a desperate wish not to be seen by anyone. In the fog of the pain which he would not define, there was also the desperate feeling that no one of those he valued, would ever wish to see him again. He knew the words which he had not uttered. He had not said that he would denounce the book in public and repudiate it in the name of the Institute. He had not said it, because he had been afraid to discover that the threat would leave Ferris unmoved, that Ferris was safe, that the word of Dr. Robert Stadler had no power any longer. And while he told himself that he would consider later the question of making a public protest, he knew that he would not make it. He picked up the book and let it drop into the wastebasket. A face came to his mind, suddenly and clearly, as if he were seeing the purity of its every line. A young face he had not permitted himself to recall for years. He thought, "No, he has not read this book. He won't see it. He's dead. He must have died long ago." The sharp pain was the shock of discovering simultaneously that this was the man he longed to see more than any other being in the world, and that he had to hope that this man was dead. He did not know why, when the telephone rang and his secretary told him that Miss Dagny Taggart was on the line, why he seized the receiver with eagerness and noticed that his hand was trembling. She would never want to see him again, he had thought for over a year. He heard her clear, impersonal voice asking for an appointment to see him. "Yes, Miss Taggart. Certainly, yes, indeed. Monday morning? Yes. Look, Miss Taggart, I have an engagement in New York today. I could drop in at your office this afternoon, if you wish." "No, no, no trouble at all. I'll be delighted." "This afternoon, Miss Taggart, about 2. I mean, about 4 o'clock. He had no engagement in New York. He did not give himself time to know what had prompted him to do it. He was smiling eagerly, looking at a patch of sunlight on a distant hill. Dagny drew a black line across train number 93 on the schedule and felt a moment's desolate satisfaction in noting that she did it calmly. It was an action which she had had to perform many times in the last 6 months. It had been hard at first. It was becoming easier. The day would come, she thought, when she would be able to deliver that death stroke even without the small salute of an effort. Train number 93 was a freight that had earned its living by carrying supplies to Hammondsville, Colorado. She knew what steps would come next. First, the death of the special freights, then the shrinking in the number of boxcars for Hammondsville, attached, like poor relatives, to the rear end of freights bound for other towns. Then the gradual cutting of the stops at Hammondsville Station from the schedules of the passenger trains. Then the day when she would strike Hammondsville, Colorado, off the map. That had been the progression of Wyatt Junction, and of the town called Stockton. She knew, once word was received, that Lawrence Hammond had retired, that it was useless to wait, to hope, and to wonder whether his cousin, his lawyer, or a committee of local citizens would reopen the plant. She knew it was time to start cutting the schedules. It had lasted less than 6 months after Ellis Wyatt had gone, that period which a columnist had gleefully called the field day of the little fellow. Every oil operator in the country who owned 3 wells and whined that Ellis Wyatt left him no chance of livelihood had rushed to fill the hole which Wyatt had left wide open. They formed leagues, cooperatives, associations. They pooled their resources and their letterheads. "The little fellow's day in the sun," the columnist had said. Their sun had been the flames that twisted through the derricks of Wyatt Oil. In its glare they made the kind of fortunes they had dreamed about, fortunes requiring no competence or effort. Then their biggest customers, such as power companies who drank oil by the trainful and would make no allowances for human frailty, began to convert to coal, and the smaller customers, who were more tolerant, began to go out of business. The boys in Washington imposed rationing on oil and an emergency tax on employers to support the unemployed oil field workers. Then a few of the big oil companies closed down. Then the little fellows in the sun discovered that a drilling bit which had cost $100 now cost them $500, there being no market for oil field equipment, and the suppliers having to earn on one drill what they had earned on 5 or perish. Then the pipelines began to close, there being no one able to pay for their upkeep. Then the railroads were granted permission to raise their freight rates, there being little oil to carry, and the cost of running tank trains having crushed 2 small lines out of existence. And when the sun went down, they saw that the operating costs, which had once permitted them to exist on their 60-acre fields, had been made possible by the miles of Wyatt's hillside, and had gone in the same coils of smoke. Not until their fortunes had vanished and their pumps had stopped did the little fellows realize that no business in the country could afford to buy oil at the price it would now take them to produce it. Then the boys in Washington granted subsidies to the oil operators. But not all of the oil operators had friends in Washington. And there followed a situation which no one cared to examine too closely or to discuss. Andrew Stockton had been in the sort of position which most of the businessmen envied. The rush to convert to coal had descended upon his shoulders like a weight of gold. He had kept his plant working around the clock, running a race with next winter's blizzards, casting parts for coal-burning stoves and furnaces. There were not many dependable foundries left. He had become one of the main pillars supporting the cellars and kitchens of the country. The pillar collapsed without warning. Andrew Stockton announced that he was retiring, closed his plant, and vanished. He left no word on what he wished to be done with the plant, or whether his relatives had the right to reopen it. There still were cars on the roads of the country, but they moved like travelers in the desert, who ride past the warning skeletons of horses bleached by the sun. They moved past the skeletons of cars that had collapsed on duty and had been left in the ditches by the side of the road. People were not buying cars any longer, and the automobile factories were closing. But there were men still able to get oil by means of friendships that nobody cared to question. These men bought cars at any price demanded. Lights flooded the mountains of Colorado from the great windows of the plant where the assembly belts of Lawrence Hammond poured trucks and cars to the sidings of Taggart Transcontinental. The word that Lawrence Hammond had retired came when least expected, brief and sudden, like the single stroke of a bell in a heavy stillness. A committee of local citizens was now broadcasting appeals on the radio, begging Lawrence Hammond, wherever he was, to give them permission to reopen his plant. There was no answer. She had screamed when Ellis Wyatt went. She had gasped when Andrew Stockton retired. When she heard that Lawrence Hammond had quit, she asked impassively, "Who's next?" "No, Miss Taggart, I can't explain it," the sister of Andrew Stockton had told her on her last trip to Colorado 2 months ago. "He never said a word to me, and I don't even know whether he's dead or living, same as Ellis Wyatt. No, nothing special had happened the day before he quit. I remember only that some man came to see him on that last evening, a stranger I'd never seen before. They talked late into the night. When I went to sleep, the light was still burning in Andrew's study." People were silent in the towns of Colorado. Dagny had seen the way they walked in the streets, past their small drug stores, hardware stores, and grocery markets, as if they hoped that the motions of their jobs would save them from looking ahead at the future. She, too, had walked through those streets, trying not to lift her head, not to see the ledges of sooted rock and twisted steel which had been the Wyatt oil fields. They could be seen from many of the towns. When she had looked ahead, she had seen them in the distance. One well on the crest of the hill was still burning. Nobody had been able to extinguish it. She had seen it from the streets, a spurt of fire, twisting convulsively against the sky as if trying to tear loose. She had seen it at night across the distance of 100 clear black miles from the window of a train, a small violent flame waving in the wind. People called it Wyatt's torch. The longest train on the John Galt line had 40 cars. The fastest ran at 50 miles an hour. The engines had to be spared. They were coal-burning engines, long past their age of retirement. Jim obtained the oil for the diesels that pulled the Comet and a few of their transcontinental freights. The only source of fuel she could count on and deal with was Ken Daniger of Daniger Coal in Pennsylvania. Empty trains clattered through the four states that were tied as neighbors to the throat of Colorado. They carried a few carloads of sheep, some corn, some melons, and an occasional farmer with an overdressed family who had friends in Washington. Jim had obtained a subsidy from Washington for every train that was run, not as a profit-making carrier, but as a service of public equality. It took every scrap of her energy to keep trains running through the sections where they were still needed, in the areas that were still producing. But on the balance sheets of Taggart Transcontinental, the checks of Jim's subsidies for empty trains bore larger figures than the profit brought by the best freight train of the busiest industrial division. Jim boasted that this had been the most prosperous 6 months in Taggart history. listed as profit on the glossy pages of his report to the stockholders, was the money he had not earned, the subsidies for empty trains, and the money he did not own, the sums that should have gone to pay the interest and the retirement of Taggart bonds, the debt which, by the will of Wesley Mooch, he had been permitted not to pay. He boasted about the greater volume of freight carried by Taggart trains in Arizona, where Dan Conway had closed the last of the Phoenix Durango and retired, and in Minnesota, where Paul Larkin was shipping iron ore by rail, and the last of the ore boats on the Great Lakes had gone out of existence.
"You have always considered money-making as such an important virtue," Jim had said to her with an odd half-smile. "Well, it seems to me that I'm better at it than you are."
Nobody professed to understand the question of the frozen railroad bonds, perhaps because everybody understood it too well. At first there had been signs of a panic among the bondholders and of a dangerous indignation among the public. Then Wesley Mooch had issued another directive, which ruled that people could get their bonds defrozen upon a plea of essential need. The government would purchase the bonds if it found the proof of the need satisfactory. There were three questions that no one answered or asked. What constituted proof? What constituted need? Essential to whom? Then it became bad manners to discuss why one man received the grant defreezing his money while another had been refused. People turned away in mouth-pinched silence if anybody asked a why. One was supposed to describe, not to explain, to catalog facts, not to evaluate them. Mr. Smith had been defrozen, Mr. Jones had not, that was all. And when Mr. Jones committed suicide, people said, "Well, I don't know, if he'd really needed his money, the government would have given it to him. But some men are just greedy." One was not supposed to speak about the men who, having been refused, sold their bonds for one-third of the value to other men who possess needs which miraculously made 33 frozen cents melt into a whole dollar, or about a new profession practiced by bright young boys just out of college who called themselves defreezers and offered their services to help you draft your application in the proper modern terms. The boys had friends in Washington. Looking at the Taggart rail from the platform of some country station, she had found herself feeling not the brilliant pride she had once felt, but a foggy, guilty shame, as if some foul kind of rust had grown on the metal, and worse, as if the rust had a tinge of blood. But then in the concourse of the terminal she looked at the statue of Nat Taggart and thought, "It was your rail. You made it. You fought for it. You were not stopped by fear or by loathing. I won't surrender it to the men of blood and rust, and I'm the only one left to guard it." She had not given up her quest for the man who invented the motor. It was the only part of her work that made her able to bear the rest. It was the only goal in sight that gave meaning to her struggle. There were times when she wondered why she wanted to rebuild that motor. "What for?" some voice seemed to ask her. "Because I'm still alive," she answered. But her quest had remained futile. Her two engineers had found nothing in Wisconsin. She had sent them to search through the country for men who had worked for 20th Century, to learn the name of the inventor. They had learned nothing. She had sent them to search through the files of the patent office. No patent for the motor had ever been registered. The only remnant of her personal quest was the stub of the cigarette with the dollar sign. She had forgotten it until a recent evening when she found it in a drawer of her desk and given it to her friend at the cigar counter of the concourse. The old man had been very astonished as he examined the stub, holding it cautiously between two fingers. He had never heard of such a brand, and wondered how he could have missed it. "Was it of good quality, Miss Taggart?" "The best I've ever smoked." He had shaken his head, puzzled. He had promised to discover where those cigarettes were made and to get her a carton. She had tried to find a scientist able to attempt the reconstruction of the motor. She had interviewed the men recommended to her as the best in their field. The first one, after studying the remnants of the motor and of the manuscript, had declared in the tone of a drill sergeant that the thing could not work, had never worked, and he would prove that no such motor could ever be made to work. The second one had drawled in the tone of an answer to a boring imposition that he did not know whether it could be done or not, and did not care to find out. The third had said, his voice belligerently insolent, that he would attempt the task on a 10-year contract at $25,000 a year. After all, Miss Taggart, if you expect to make huge profits on that motor, it's you who should pay for the gamble of my time. The fourth, who was the youngest, had looked at her silently for a moment, and the lines of his face had slithered from blankness into a suggestion of contempt. You know, Miss Taggart, I don't think that such a motor should ever be made, even if somebody did learn how to make it. It would be so superior to anything we've got that it would be unfair to lesser scientists, because it would leave no field for their achievements and abilities. I don't think that the strong should have the right to wound the self-esteem of the weak. She had ordered him out of her office and had sat in incredulous horror before the fact that the most vicious statement she had ever heard had been uttered in a tone of moral righteousness. The decision to speak to Dr. Robert Stadler had been her last recourse. She had forced herself to call him against the resistance of some immovable point within her that felt like brakes slammed tight. She had argued against herself. She had thought, I deal with men like Jim and Orrin Boyle. His guilt is less than theirs. Why can't I speak to him? She had found no answer, only a stubborn sense of reluctance, only the feeling that of all the men on earth, Dr. Robert Stadler was the one she must not call. As she sat at her desk over the schedules of the John Galt line, waiting for Dr. Stadler to come, she wondered why no first-rate talent had risen in the field of science for years. She was unable to look for an answer. She was looking at the black line, which was the corpse of train number 93 on the schedule before her. A train has the two great attributes of life, she thought, motion and purpose. This had been like a living entity, but now it was only a number of dead freight cars and engines. Don't give yourself time to feel, she thought. Dismember the carcass as fast as possible. The engines are needed all over the system. Ken Daniger in Pennsylvania needs trains, more trains, if only. Dr. Robert Stadler, said the voice of the inter-office communicator on her desk. He came in smiling. The smile seemed to underscore his words. Miss Taggart, would you care to believe how helplessly glad I am to see you again? She did not smile. She looked gravely courteous as she answered, It was very kind of you to come here. She bowed, her slender figure standing tautly straight, but for the slow, formal movement of her head. What if I confess that all I needed was some plausible excuse in order to come? Would it astonish you? I would not try to overtax your courtesy. She did not smile. Please sit down, Dr. Stadler. He looked brightly around him. I've never seen the office of a railroad executive. I didn't know it would be so solemn a place. Is that in the nature of the job? The matter on which I'd like to ask your advice is far removed from the field of your interests, Dr. Stadler. You may think it odd that I should call on you. Please allow me to explain my reason. The fact that you wish to call on me is a fully sufficient reason. If I can be of any service to you, any service whatever, I don't know what would please me more at this moment. His smile had an attractive quality, the smile of a man of the world, who used it not to cover his words, but to stress the audacity of expressing a sincere emotion. My problem is a matter of technology, she said in the clear, expressionless tone of a young mechanic, discussing a difficult assignment. I fully realize your contempt for that branch of science. I do not expect you to solve my problem. It is not the kind of work which you do or care about. I should like only to submit the problem to you, and then I'll have just two questions to ask you. I had to call on you because it is a matter that involves someone's mind, a very great mind. And, she spoke impersonally, in the manner of rendering exact justice, and you are the only great mind left in this field. She could not tell why her words hit him as they did. She saw the stillness of his face, the sudden earnestness of the eyes, a strange earnestness that seemed eager and almost pleading. Then she heard his voice come gravely, as if from under the pressure of some emotion that made it sound simple and humble. What is your problem, Miss Taggart?